Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And boy, do we have a fun and ocean-going episode of This Week in Law for you. We've got Omar Todd with us from the Sea Shepherd down in the Southern Whale Sanctuary. We've got Derek Bambauer from Brooklyn Law School. We've got cyber lawyer Kevin Thompson. And we're going to talk about the convergence of technology, communications, and the law, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 157, recorded April 13, 2012. A lawyer in every port. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hi, folks, it's Denise Howell, and you've joined us for This Week in Law. And this week in law, we've got three lawyers and a seafaring vigilante bringing to you here on the show. Very excited to introduce you to Omar Todd, who is the chief technical officer, all-around techie communications guy for the Sea Shepherd and their entire fleet. Hello, Omar.
Hello there.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. In doing a little research on you and getting ready for the show, you have one of the greatest Twitter taglines I've ever read. So I'll just use that by way of introduction to folks who aren't familiar with you. You're a transhumanist Aussie, Dutch-German with an Arabic name, film producer for Cinemagine Films, Sea Shepherd technical director, that's the Whale Wars show on Animal Planet for anyone who's not familiar, and cricket fanatic. Omar, I've got to tell you, when I've watched episodes of Whale Wars, thinking of you sitting around watching cricket matches on the boats is not the first thing that came to my mind.
Well, yes, it's only a recent event that we've even watched cricket on the boats, because now we have satellite access all around the world. So and it streams too. So we can actually watch a cricket game when I've got to be careful. I just want me see a bit of cricket on TV while they're all got limited access. So I have to be a little bit careful and sneak a view here and there when I can.
Well, far be it for you guys to bend any rules. So we wouldn't expect that of you at all. Also joining us today from the No Sleep Till Brooklyn Law School, Derek Bambauer. Hello, Derek.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. I'm very excited to get you on the show, and we'll talk later about a cool event that's going on at your school a little later on in the week on Sunday. And you've been paying attention to some very interesting legislation in Arizona that I also want to get into a bit later on the show. So it's great to have you.
Thanks so much.
Also joining us once again is the cyber lawyer himself from Davis McGrath in Chicago, Kevin Thompson.
Well, thanks for having me, Denise. It's a pleasure to be back on.
It's great to see you again, Kevin. All right. Well, since it's 2 a.m. in Australia where Omar is, I thought we'd maybe get into some stuff about the Sea Shepherd and the things that you guys are contending with and have contended with over the years, and particularly in your capacity as technical director. Omar, I think you'll have some interesting perspectives for our listeners and viewers on the show. So one thing I noticed is that you guys are involved in litigation that was filed in Seattle, Washington, in the United States, that actually was filed by the Japanese folks. Let's see, their acronym is sort of euphemistic, has something to do with research, the Cetacean Research Society. Do I have that right?
Yeah, the Cetacean Research Society. That's correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. all part of the International Whaling Commission, and they all have their little organisations that they like acronyms. And but basically, I mean, this is not my area, but they tried to prevent us from continuing our anti-whaling activities down in the Southern Ocean during the campaign by filing an injunction. And if you look through the court transcripts, and they're readily online, in fact, they're off our website, it's quite interesting where they come in under the angle that, of course, that we are terrorists and, you know, dangerous. And of course, the judge, you know, would explain, well, you know, can you prove they've proved these claims? And, you know, what? Why would this jurisdiction in the US have any control on what happens in the Southern Ocean? So there was a jurisdiction issue. And then, of course, Australian has had its own court action against the Japanese whaling fleets in the past, and we've had our own federal court order which prevents them technically from whaling in the Southern Oceans in the Australian Economic Zone, which they're continuing to ignore. So the US or the judge also mentioned, well, if you know, if you're ignoring an Australian federal court order by being down there, you know, why have you chosen this jurisdiction instead? And of course, it comes down to the fact that Sea Shepherd has the 501 charity status in the US, and I think they felt that if they can attack the headquarters of Sea Shepherd and perhaps the charity status, then if they could remove that, then they would, you know, effectively kick the chair from under us. But at this stage, the judge wasn't too impressed with their submissions and tossed them out to a point. And it goes to, I think they've just recently, I think yesterday or the day before, they've actually filed an appeal on that.
Right. Well, it's pretty interesting. It sounds like the judge wants them to not be in violation of any laws or equitable considerations, if he's going to even consider acting on their request to enjoin your activities, which is a pretty reasonable thing for the judge to do. So it sounds like they may have opened the door for consideration of a legal issue that they never wanted heard in a U.S. court.
That's right. And also, it's a can of worms for anyone to litigate with this. You've got three different ships registered in three different jurisdictions, of which none of them are in the US. You've got a Southern Ocean where it's technically under international law, which is, you know, previously the rule of might, and the fleets usually tend to back up any laws down there. If you don't have a fleet down there, then really the rule of law doesn't mean too much. I mean, you know, that's the problem with the Somalian pirates, and you know, Australia claims the area down there, but that doesn't mean that anyone, you know, has to actually, you know, follow the rules or believe it. And Japan doesn't agree with Australia's claim of the area. So it's a interesting angle. I think if I was a lawyer, and you know, obviously what your program's about, it's a very fascinating you know, play on the law and just how far a jurisdiction can go. You've got all these interesting aspects, you know, ships from different jurisdictions that are registered in different countries, an area of the seas that are just outside the usual laws. So, you know, a charity-based organization in the US that's having its charity status attacked while being a very popular organization, and of course with a TV show. So it's definitely something down the road that we could almost write a book or perhaps even a movie about.
Exactly. And you're in what, the seventh season of the show right now?
The fifth season. We're in the fifth season of the show. Yeah, fifth season of the show. However, this year we've really ramped up the episodes. I mean, typically we have, you know, 12, 13 episodes every year. But now we have some specials this year. We have the Viking Shore, which is based in the Faroe Islands, and it's a six-part episode series. We have a Galapagos Islands special, and we have a Nambian Seals special as well. So we've actually got the main Whale Wars Antarctica show, and plus we've got three specials attached to it. So I think over 20 episodes this year. So, you know, we're really bringing the plight of these various issues to the public as best we can while the show's so popular, and you know, it is very popular at the moment.
Right, and I'm sure you as the technology and communications director have some head-to-head contact with all of those complicated legal issues that you were mentioning a moment ago. I was reading that in 2009 you guys were actually boarded, and all of this reminded me, you know, on a much grander scale of what we saw in the U.S. Last year, I think it was, gosh, time flies, it may have been 2 years ago now, when Jason Chen of Gizmodo's computers and files, et cetera, were seized in the investigation of a clandestine iPhone 4 that was reported on.
This.
But yeah, you remember that. So you guys were boarded in a similar way and had a very broad, sweeping request for information served on you because your Japanese opponents were alleging that you guys had rammed some of their ships. And so the Australian authorities came down on you guys. Were you there on the boat when that happened?
I have been on the boat at the time for a couple of these incidents. The interesting thing about this is that you can tell the federal police turn up. They're reluctant. They turn up. They sort of, hello, and they're very friendly, fantastic supporters of Sea Shepherd. One even showed us on his phone that he actually had the screensaver as a Sea Shepherd logo. So they cruise around. They technically confiscate any footage they find, and they sort of drag their feet and arms around while they have to confiscate the footage, take it back because of Japan's complaint. Now, interesting enough, it's never led to anything, and we expected the usual this year. And when we landed this year, for the first time, I think, in a number of years, there was no one there. And, no one boarded this year. And, in fact, in Melbourne, when we landed in one of the ships in Melbourne, we did have the, I believe it was the Sea Patrol police turn up and actually offer their time to volunteer to scrape some of the rust off the ship. So we have excellent support in Australia and from the Australian people in regards to this. And I think this year when the Japan and their number of their ships are actually recorded being within Australian territory, within the 16 nautical mile area, which they're not supposed to be, they've really pushed some buttons here on a national scale. So there's people that are feeling pretty strongly against whaling. And of course, once they found out that the ships were actually within our waters, our legal waters, not just our economic territory waters, but within, very so close to the shore, it's only helped our cause. And of course, you may have heard of the forest rescue men as well, who also jumped on the ship and on one of the Japanese ships, and of course an international outrage, you know, and some drama there. So I'm not sure if you actually heard of that.
No, I had not. So that's fascinating. Hey, we've got the benefit of having an information law professor with us today. So, Derek, I don't want to put you on the spot vis-a-vis international or maritime or Australian law, but I don't know if you had the chance to read the story about one of the various seizures they were subject to. I was struck by the breadth of the warrant, which asked for all edited and raw video footage, all edited and raw audio recordings, all still photographs, producer's notes, interview transcripts, production meeting minutes, post-production meeting minutes, as well as the ship's logbooks, global positioning system records, automatic radar plotting aid, purchase records, receipts, financial transaction records, voyage information, and navigational plotted charts. Is this something that you think may have been a little overreaching on the part of the judge who granted this warrant?
My sense is that it is, and I think it's actually in some ways a failure to adequately supervise the warrant, is that this isn't so much about using the warrant as a means of discovering evidence for pursuing a crime or whatnot. It's really just intended to impose a transaction cost on the organization. And that's precisely why we're supposed to have disinterested magistrates, is so that they prevent this type of abuse by private parties. And, it's unfortunate we see it in the states as well, with sort of overbroad warrants sweeping in a lot of evidence. And it strikes me that this really puts Sea Shepherd in a difficult position, because if they comply, it's enormously burdensome. And if they don't, they're potentially under penalties of contempt.
Right. So, Omar, do you remember what happened, or what has happened when these sorts of things has happened? I guess there has not just been one incidence of this.
Yeah, there's not been one incident. I mean, it's interesting you actually you read out the actual, the information from the warrant itself. I remember it I mean, again, it wasn't my area, so I was just more amused by the you know, the fact that they weren't that interested, and they seemed to casually grab what they needed, and we offered anything they needed, but we gave the information that they requested, and I think the information on the warrant, you know, they didn't get all of that. They just got, you know, bits and pieces. They got the footage. I mean, of course, you've got to remember, you've got Animal Planet on there with high definition footage as well. It's reasonably unrealistic for them to take all this. It just doesn't work that way. So I think they did their job within reason, but I think, you know, some of it could have just got lost in the post, so to speak. So it wasn't really difficult or you know, hard for us to come up with information, because they weren't that detailed about what they wanted, even though the piece of paper itself may have been different. But we certainly complied with anything they requested in person, and they were very friendly, and we were very friendly, and it took a couple of hours, but no problem.
Right. There was one little detail in the coverage of this that I had to pull out and ask you about. The Japanese were alleging that you guys had rammed their ships, and you folks countered that they were using a sonic weapon to disable the crew. Now, this strikes me as straight out of a book like Demon, which I read a few months ago. How did that work?
Yeah, well, they have acoustic sound device weapons, which basically they, you know, it's funny. They talk about us being violent. You know, here we are throwing, you know, stinky butter at them and a little bit of paint, and we harass their ships a little bit. And then they will throw concussion grenades, these military style acoustic weapons, long range acoustic weapons, LRADs are called. When they also pointed it out to Chris Altman, actually, one of our helicopter pilots, while he was in the air going around the ships, which is, you know, can be quite dangerous and disorientating. And it's, you know, they have spent quite a lot of money and significant money upgrading their fleet. And last year they spent around $28 million. Of the tsunami funds, that the relief funds that were sent around from around the world, specifically on the security of their fleet. And even the Prime Minister of Japan named us personally as an organisation that should be punished, and pretty much declared war on us himself. So, you know, here we are, a small little non-profit organisation trying to save whales, who are our clients, against Japan. And it seems to be a little bit, something that we just can't quite understand why they don't give up. They're using the most advanced weapons. They're using, difficult tactics, expensive PR campaigns, and it's an industry that loses money every year. It's a completely government subsidized industry. So, you know, it's a strange business to see actually in person, and you scratch your head and you think, well, why do these people continue to do this? It doesn't seem to be any point.
We're going to talk a little later on the show about a court here in the United States, the Ninth Circuit, finding that violations of employer policies by employees in their use of the web can't be construed as a crime under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And Omar, I was just wondering if you've ever encountered, in your capacity as technical director, your opponents trying to get creative with the laws of the various places that you might be in and targeting your uses of technology and communications as, you know, in furtherance of your goals, as violating some local law and trying to go after you that way.
You know, I could talk to you guys hours about the interesting things that are happening in the cyber world. You know, whereas we're using technologies unknown before, UAVs last year, we used drones to actually track the ships down. We used social media extensively. And the changes just in the last couple of years that we've, as a small organization, have adjusted to the online world. In regards to them using, they actually pay agents to go on various social network areas, forums and things like that, which we've discovered, to try to persuade other public people or, you know, other users to be against us. And we have found that there's a number of paid people that that try to be that try to use publicity against us. So the cyber area and the cyber war between the organizations' philosophies are actually it's becoming quite intense. And you know, we're now treating social media like like a fourth ship, like a total entity on its own that requires resources, crew and people, and you know, and I think they're the same. And the whole battleground of this area is being rewritten in the last couple of years. You know, now on the Sea of Irvine, we have a C-band satellite dish. I can't go into too much details, but I can say that we have high-speed bandwidth all around the world, on-demand streaming. We have a number of high-definition cameras on board. We have many CCTV cameras on board. And, you know, it's our war is almost, on the information side, is almost, if not almost, more important now than the actual actions on the sea. So it's becoming a very interesting area and seeing it develop. And I'm spending more and more time every day countering, you know, online publicity that's adverse or not adverse, and, you know, trying to get support and all the latest social networks we're integrating with. It's becoming, you know, an area that's growing very quickly. And, you know, my job is it started part-time, but it's more than full-time now. I think a number of us are juggling, you know, five jobs at once. You know, I could be on the ship one day and then I could be spending two or three days on social media. So right. It's becoming quite interesting.
Well, that's how we met. You set up a Google Plus page and emailed me just a random user question about Google Plus, and I was thrilled to meet you and get to know firsthand what you guys are doing on the social media front. So it's great that you're using that in your overall efforts. I do want to move on to some non-Sea Shepherd topics today, but before I do, I just wondered, Kevin, do you have any Sea Shepherd-related questions for Omar before we move on to other things?
That's a good question. I thought it was interesting that you know, Omar is talking about the fourth boat, where we might think of the press as the fourth estate,
right?
Here that they've got the fourth boat, which is good. I was sort of curious, you know, like when they did have the seizures and they took the footage and stuff like that. Was there a bit of a lag before you got that stuff back? Was it turned back over in any reasonable length of time, Omar?
By memory, and it's happened a couple of times now, I think once it took a while, a couple of months, and then as the years have progressed, it's got quicker and quicker. The impression we get is that the authorities on our side, the Australian side, because obviously I'm Australian, have become more disinterested in following this mandate every year that they're forced to do, to the point where this year they didn't even show up. And this year, you know, when we see the shore and we're coming up, and I wasn't on campaign, but we have, you know, we have the lawyer numbers out and we're ready to call the lawyers as soon as we jump on shore and we're arrested, and but nothing happened last year. So in the past, it originally was a long time, I think, you know, a number of months, but as the years have gone, it's got shorter and easier, and we've become much more friendlier with the authorities. And I think, you know, most Australians, even the ones that are forced to do the job, are actually quite supportive of Sea Shepherd. But that's certainly our impression anyway.
How about you, Derek?
Okay, thanks.
Anything you're dying to know?
I was just wondering if Sea Shepherd has the ability to do anything in real time to share these things sort of live, as it were.
Very good question. I mean, in a show like this, you know, I have to gloss over a lot of detail. As I said, I could spend hours telling you about the technologies we're developing. I mean, next year is going to be an amazing year. We're using technologies that are frankly almost Star Trek level stuff. And no one and no other charity on the planet, as far as I can tell, will be using the stuff we're playing with at the moment. And a lot of it will be real time. You know, I'm now dabbling with Hangouts. In fact, I jump on the Bridget Bardot for a crossing in a couple of days from Perth to Melbourne. We're going to, you know, do some sea trials, and I'm going to be experimenting with Google Hangouts. And, you know, if people want to find our Google page, and I will be showing people in real time what's it like to crew on the ship. And, you know, And on our primary ships this upcoming season, hopefully we won't have one down the Antarctica, but I suspect we probably will. There's going to be some amazing technology, and I wish I could talk about it, but I can't. But there's going to be some pretty amazing things. Although keeping in mind, in the one area we're restricted to is because we've got Animal Planet on board, we're restricted to a point on what we can send out in real time. Because, you know, they've got the rights to the footage originally. So we're on a very strict diet on what we can release because obviously it affects the show.
Right. Hey, I wanted to ask you specifically about that, actually. I'm noticing that the show is available on iTunes and Amazon. And I wondered if you know, as a producer yourself and as someone integrally involved in generating the content for this show for the Animal Planet, if you have any thoughts on, you know, the web versus TV distribution. That's a topic that we touch on a lot on the show.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm off to Cannes shortly. I've just produced a film called Sparks and Embers, which is a romantic comedy based in London, and it's a traditional format. And my partner, a guy called Benjamin Craig, who's Daniel Craig's cousin, you know, the 007 James Bond fellow, he wrote his dissertation on this exact topic recently, a few years ago. And we've been talking a lot about it in Cannes Film Festival, and I've been there last year. It's come up a lot more. And on one of my other projects, it's called The Dream Channel. It's a transmedia project where it's a online game on the web where people can join and then they become characters that win and get into a movie. So we're combining a game and a movie together in a transmedia way. So the industry is looking at the online content. It's looking at streaming. It's looking at movies. But it can't quite wrap its head around the distribution of it. This is what's slowing it down. You know, people have got very expensive distribution networks and they don't want to let go. So I think the next 3 to 4 years, people are going to, in the industry, are going to try to find ways to distribute content out through iTunes and Netflix and all these other new mediums without losing footage, foothold in the old distribution channels. But they will have to change. So from our point of view, yes, we are all looking at it in the industry, and it's certainly talked about all the time.
Right. You guys are sort of in the position where you could almost be a direct provider of all the coverage of what you're doing and, you know, just pick and choose among the various distribution channels that you use. So I think you're
If Animal Planet is not on a campaign, say, for instance, we're doing a shark campaign mm-hmm. shortly and it's a smaller campaign, well, you know, we'll probably experiment with being streaming out straight from the internet, straight up and distributing it through, you know, millions of followers around the world. So we're definitely going to be looking at stuff as the year goes on. It's going to be quite an interesting year in technology-wise.
And then we have one question from our IRC. Virgil there wants to know if you salvage the Gojira.
Oh, the Gojira. No. it was taking on water. Was towed for a period of an evening and it was taking on water, so we had to scuttle it. So we removed all the gear on there. We removed the fuel. We stripped it down. And unfortunately, she had to be let go. You can read all about it. Just do the do a search on Artie Gill sinking. And of course, we replaced that ship with what we originally called it, the Gojira, but now it's called the Bridget Bardot, which was the daddy actually of the Artie Gill. It's a much larger ship and probably a little stronger and safer. And now that it's just had been upgraded, and we're about to, as I said, jump on it from Perth to Melbourne and see how it goes. But the original Artie Gill ship, which most people confuse with the Gojira because they look very similar, but the Artie Gill was only a much smaller vessel, and the Gojira or the Bridget Bardot is a much larger vessel. I hope I answered that question right.
Okay, I think you did. All right, so let's move on to that point that I raised a moment ago. There was a Ninth Circuit decision in the U.S. versus Nozzle case, which is good news for all of us who are employed and maybe using their computer every now and again to check Facebook or purchase something on Amazon or something that might be technically in violation of the employer's computer usage policies. The Ninth Circuit, with Judge Kaczynski writing for the entire panel of 11 judges on the court, with only one dissenter, has decided that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act cannot be invoked there to turn those acts into criminal events, which I have to think is a good thing, although there are several other circuits in the United States that have come down on the opposite side of that question. So this is the kind of thing that would be ripe to go before the Supreme Court at some point. Derek, have you read through Judge Kaczynski's opinion, which is always a good entertaining thing to do? I haven't yet had the chance to do that. And do you have any thoughts on the case?
I think it's a sensible outcome, and you're right that it does set up a circuit split over the CFAA, and it, in some ways it recapitulates the discussions a few years ago from the Lori Drew case about the Meghan Myers suicide. And in some ways, this is more sensible because it's awfully difficult, right, to determine when you violated your employer's terms of use. So as you say, if your employer says, well, you know, you're not permitted to go on eBay during work hours, and you just absolutely have to sort of bid on that lunchbox, then you might actually violate that, and thereby everything that you're doing on the network at that point is technically a violation of the CFAA. There's some limits in there in terms of your employer's claims against you. There's a damages minimum, but it is not something that would limit an overzealous prosecutor. And so in some ways, this is really a question as much about notice as it is about authorization itself.
Right. Kevin, do you think this case is going to have any broad-reaching ramifications, and you think we may see it in the Supreme Court?
I think it's a good chance we'll see it in the Supreme Court in some fashion. Maybe not this case, but maybe another case might, you know, point out the split in the circuits. The Seventh Circuit is one of the ones that has taken a different point of view. And I actually went back to try to look at that case. It's the 2006 case with very, very similar facts, where you have someone with a someone breaching their terms of use, more of a, again, a trade secret case, where people have taken the you know, employer's private data and used it for you know, the starting a competing company. So, you know, even though this particular part of the decision, you know, just deals with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claims, I think, you know, these people have, you know, a lot of other charges to answer for in relating to, you know, trade secret and so forth. The dissent is actually quite interesting reading. I would suggest people, if they read the opinion, be sure to read the dissent as well. And they certainly point out, the one judge there that dissented, is that they're going pretty far out there to, you know, talk about all these other things that might be violations of the terms of use, such as going on Facebook or other personal uses that might be technically be violations, when they may not necessarily have had to do so to address the allegations. In this particular case, where these people were employees who accessed their employer's private data, you know, for the purpose of taking the data and using it to start a competing company. I don't think there's much doubt that they exceeded the authorization that was granted them by their employer when they did that. I think the dissent points out that they didn't have to go as far as they did in, you know, talking about this general rule, you know, that of, you know, that, you know, exceeding the scope of that shouldn't be a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violation, where they could have addressed the specific allegations in this case a little more narrowly.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting that when you read the opinion, Judge Kaczynski's actually sort of begging the other circuits to reconsider and describing how he thinks that they decided those cases based on the individual facts, where they wanted to go after some people who were engaged in some pretty bad activities, as opposed to simply using the computer network for things that technically weren't authorized. And he points out in a dramatic kind of way how a lot of pretty innocent activities could be swept under the rubric of a U.S. federal crime, and how this could be used to intimidate employees by saying, you know, well, if you don't just voluntarily quit, we'll go ahead and let the authorities know that, you know, you were violating our policies, and that's a federal crime. So I do think it will be interesting to see if this decision has any broader impact on the other circuits that have gone the other way, or potentially on the Supreme Court, which does not love the Ninth Circuit. But this seems to be a situation where maybe it would go against the grain on that. Omar, it must be pretty interesting on the Sea Shepherd. You know, if somebody were to violate your secrecy strictures, yeah, I have the feeling you wouldn't wait around for a U.S. federal law or anything else to deal with that.
No, we've had this problem. When we're on the ships, I have to restrict the internet, you know, heavily. Well, basically unplug it to a point. Only the officers and the commissioned officers and all that can be on it. And, you know, we've also had you know, people, you know, who unintentionally jump on Facebook and say, "Hi, everyone, we're at these coordinates. Look at us, yay!" And of course, we're like, "Oh, geez, don't say that." However, on a separate issue, we've now started to use that to our advantage. You know, a couple of years ago, before my time, I'd like to add, we're a little bit green, and people would, you know, put their coordinates up. But now we've actually used, you know, similar. You know, no one's quite sure where we are and what we're doing, because people, you know, people, we have entire forums dedicated to gossiping about us and what we're doing and what we're thinking. It's quite astounding, particularly when you're reading it from where, you know, when you're actually sitting on a ship or you're sitting elsewhere and you're actually reading what they're discussing. But yeah, it's becoming an interesting area. And of course, these days, the disclosures and NDAs I have to get crew to sign is almost as long as an encyclopedia now. So, and I've recently just had to write up a sort of cyber document and cyber policy and social media policy documents as well. Mm-hmm. It's interesting actually, because I've got another interview with with your colleagues here from Cyber Law PL, which is Bulgaria, I believe, have also want to talk to us about some of the documentations we've written. So it's an area that is expanding. But yes, is the answer. It's becoming quite interesting.
Yes. Well, thanks for sharing that. You know, I mean, the Sea Shepherd is an organization, an employer, just like any other in some ways, and yet it's quite unique in several others. Let's talk, Derek, about this law in Arizona that passed but is being amended. It is HB 2549. It's interesting because there are so many states who are interested in passing something to make people feel secure that they're not going to be bullied online, they're not going to be harassed online. There is a lot of public concern about those issues these days. And so Arizona was forging ahead to do something about that. But what they purported to do, at least in the initial version of the legislation as it was passed, was to make it unlawful to annoy or offend people online, among other things. Omar, I think that might mean that all that fourth boat activity that you've been engaged in could be subject to criminal prosecution in Arizona. Derek, why don't you tell us about this law and where it stands now?
So you explained it really well, Denise, which is that this is an attempt by the Arizona legislature to do something completely laudable, which is to deal with the problems of cyber harassment and cyberbullying online. The difficulty is they just didn't do a good job of it. So they took a statute that was drafted for the age of the Bell telephone system, and they tried to just sort of dump in the word electronic or digital everywhere that you see telephone, and then passed it. And so it seems something where... The the sponsors, the drafters of the bill, didn't actually think that there were any constitutional problems with it, and they didn't appear to have asked for much input on it. And interestingly, it passed both houses of the Arizona legislature, and it's now sitting out there, and Governor Brewer apparently can sign it at her discretion. And the sponsors are trying now to redraft it to deal with the sort of really obvious constitutional flaws that the bill has. And it's going to be interesting to see if they're able to do so. The changes that have been reported in the press wouldn't be sufficient to save the bill. And I'm moving to Arizona in the summer to start at the University of Arizona's law school, and have already said that if they don't fix the bill, which is just tremendously overbroad and unconstitutional at this point, we'll be in court as soon as I get there to enjoin.
Wonderful. Good for you. That was propitious timing on your move. And that's great that you get to start the law school there. Very fun pioneering activity. Kevin, any thoughts on this particular law and its impact on speech and freedom online?
Well, I agree that it is certainly overbroad as drafted. I certainly hope that they're able to get it amended in any timely fashion. I don't have much more to say other than that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a challenge for lots and lots of states and possibly the federal government in the United States, you know, because this concern about harassment and bullying is a real one. You know, we talked about the Lori Drew case a few minutes ago, and, you know, the reason they tried to shoehorn that into the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is because lawmakers, judges, legislators are looking for ways to be able to police things that just shouldn't be happening online, or that, you know, were overly violent or otherwise threatening. And yet we have to be sure to protect free speech too. So it's a very delicate balance. Derek, do you think that any other states are doing a better job of this than Arizona did on its go round?
Actually, there are a number of better examples, and I guess that's what's disappointing ultimately about the Arizona law, is that there are models out there that address exactly the problems the Arizona legislature is worried about, which is things like threats or stalking or repeated harassment online. So California, for example, has a provision that deals with threatening language online that I think is well-tailored. It covers exactly the type of speech that we're worried about. It does so in a way that's narrower. And so there are really two issues here. The first issue is about making the bill constitutional. And the second question is a larger one, which is what do we think is problematic online, and what sort of tolerance do we have for bad behavior online? And also just what bad behavior does the Constitution require that we tolerate online? So the Arizona bill, for example, talks about language that is lewd or profane or annoying or offensive. And that means that my blog is illegal in Arizona, despite the fact that it's a law blog. And so I think that what is required in some ways is to have some modesty about our goals and to target speech that we think is or conduct that is particularly harmful, like threats and like harassment. And so there are actually good examples, California's, I think, being one of them, that Arizona could look to. And then, in fact, I've encouraged the drafters of the bill to look to.
All right. Well, we will continue to monitor that issue. It's a big one in the U.S. and I'm sure elsewhere. Kevin, what do you think about this other issue that continues to raise its head from time to time, the legality of embedding videos that may be infringing? The MPAA has filed an amicus brief in a case where it has taken the position that sort of activity might actually constitute direct infringement. What do you think about that?
Well, once again, that's the Seventh Circuit here taking the national spotlight on this particular issue. Should be interesting to see how the case turns out. I did manage to read through the MPAA's brief, they take a very interesting look at just general issues of copyright law, and what they're focusing on is that violations of the display right, which would be the embedding, should be looked at separate from what would be the reproduction right, which would be the actual people putting it on their servers and just distributing the video. There is a Ninth Circuit case where they have a test where they look at, you know, whose server essentially is the video on, and the MPAA is arguing that the reproduction right should be treated separately, and so it shouldn't matter whose server it's on, and whether or not you've infringed the reproduction right before whether or not they can find a violation of the display right, and it should be interesting to see how that plays out in the end, and how receptive other people are to that type of an argument. I did read through some other briefs as well. I read through the EFF's brief, but which was filed last year, and so it didn't really address that particular question.
Yeah, so it seems like they're arguing that you could have direct copyright infringement without any actual copying. Derek, what do you think about that?
So I think it's entirely possible as a theoretical matter. The derivative mm-hmm. works right. Example, there are the famous tile art cases out there where you don't have to have any copying whatsoever. And so, people have said that in the Ninth Circuit, at least, if you sort of make notes in the margin of a book, you've probably created a derivative work. I think that the difficulty for the MPAA is to think about how far this rule that they propose cuts. Because if it's one, for example, where potentially if they fell outside of the Digital Land and Copyright Act's safe harbor, all internet service providers and all web hosts would be liable for violations of the display right, I think that that's something that a court would be really reluctant to embrace.
Yeah, it seems like one of those things Judge Kaczynski could write eloquently about, sweeping a lot of innocent activity under too broad an umbrella. All righty then, let's talk to big news this week, Instagram acquired by Facebook. On the legal side, I guess, and we have a funny tweet that sort of captures the humorous aspect of the legal side. If Chad can put that up for us, there it is. And it would, yeah, there we go. So we've got Poor Me Coffee saying, Facebook buying Instagram to provide seamless integration between photos of your dinner and the people who don't want to see them. And now, well, that is a pretty funny way of encapsulating it. I think a lot of people are concerned that by using Instagram for their photos, they were making some choices about who they were going to share those photos with that might be different choices than their universe of followers and connections on Facebook. And now I think the concern is that those two things might be combined and those expectations would be upended. Kevin, do you think this is a big deal or no?
Well, there was a good article which looked at the actual terms of service. The actual terms aren't all that different between Instagram and Facebook. But I think there certainly are some different uses. I think people use Instagram a lot more to take just general snapshots and, share them around versus necessarily, wanting to be sort of the more permanent social record and shared among all your Facebook friends and so forth. So I do think there are different audiences, and I think that's why, Facebook bought them, was to get access to that, 30 million users that they developed with pretty much a lot of that is just iOS users. They only just recently added an Android app. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's certainly a different audience there. For Facebook, why they probably, thought they were worth the money. Although I must admit, when I first heard the price, I was quite shocked and knew that I was in the wrong line of work.
Yeah, exactly. The price of coolness, I guess.
Right.
Which I think Facebook is going to have to struggle to maintain.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think generally, though, the thing to keep in mind, though, when you're using Instagram or any other service is, you know, public postings are public. And, you know, the terms, you know, can change from time to time, you know, sometimes without notice, depending on what service you're using. And Instagram people are certainly going to be discovering once Facebook announces how this will actually integrate, just what changes are going to make. So I think it's, you know, stay tuned. I know some people have taken the point of view that if Facebook bought them, you know, they're certainly, you know, not going to stay an Instagram user. And that's certainly a choice that people can make. But I don't think that's by any means that can be the majority. I think, you know, a lot of people are going to stick around and see what changes come to Instagram as a result of this acquisition and, you know, whether or not, you know, that they can, you know, keep their public pictures there.
Right. I mean, it could just remain entirely the way it is, just be under the Facebook umbrella. That's what they did with FriendFeed when they bought it. It's exactly same as it's always been. Derek, any thoughts on this one?
You know, I think what's interesting about this is that it's a really helpful set of insights that Kevin has about the privacy policy. And it's thoughtful to look at the differences, but I wonder, as a practical matter, how much difference they make. Facebook's privacy policy is impossible to read. Most users don't read it. What really matters, I think, is Denise, exactly your point, is whether or not the service stays the same. Is that by and large, everyone bemoans the fact, and rightly so, that users just don't care that much about privacy online. And so if they're getting the functionality that they want, then I think that they'll stay with Instagram. You know, every time that Google integrates its privacy policies or Facebook makes a minor change, it blows up in the tech media for a couple of days, and then things go back to normal.
All right. Well, Kevin has a train to catch, and I don't want him to miss it. So we're going to let him go. Thank
this
you so much, Kevin,
time.
For joining us.
And thanks again, Denise, for having me. And, you know, if Evan is, you know, busy again at some other point, but by all means, let me know and I'll see if I can help you out again.
Sure. Thank you so much for doing that. And we're going to have you on when Evan is with us, too, because that's always fun as well. So go get your train. We're going to keep this train going in your absence. But we wish you well. Take care.
Thanks. Have a great day now.
All right. You too. And I'll go ahead and take this opportunity to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Netflix. Folks, I know you probably already use Netflix, but if you don't, we have a great 30-day free trial for you to take advantage of or to tell your friend or your mom or some family member who just maybe hasn't quite got on the Netflix train yet, that there's a great way to try it for 30 days absolutely for free. And the reason you want to do that is because of the thousands of TV episodes and movies that are available for streaming there directly to you instantly. It saves you time, money, and hassle, and it gives you access to this just incredible world of entertainment that, you know, particularly if you have kids and you're concerned about them having great things to watch, but not being bombarded by 20 minutes of commercials for every hour. This is a really wonderful way to go. My kid right now is watching the entire Tintin animated cartoon series that he's just totally in love with. So that's just one of many, many examples of the material that will be there for you to stream. And you can access all that material in so many easy and instant ways. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your PC, Mac, or iPad. There's a beautiful app for the iPad and the iPhone, and some Android phones too. If you have a gaming console, the Xbox 360, the PS3, the Nintendo Wii will all bring you Netflix into your home. If you're not a gamer, there are so many ways to bring it in through a set-top box, either an Apple TV or a Roku. Lots and lots of DVD players are making this completely seamless. In fact, we just got a new receiver that has Netflix on it, of all things. So, you know, it's just being built into so many components that make it almost silly not to have an account. You can watch all of that wonderful material instantly using any of those devices, and you can begin watching on one device and then finish on a different one. However you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So go to netflix.com/twit for that 30-day free trial I was mentioning. When you use that URL, it lets them know that we sent you there, which we really appreciate. And we also really appreciate Netflix's support of This Week in Tech and This Week in Law. We hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. So, Omar, I have a question for you that wasn't in our discussion points, but I wonder, since you're in Australia, if it's something that you've been paying attention to. There's been some interesting coverage of the Australian government suing people for use of Wi-Fi, that they have some patents and have reached some huge settlements from Wi-Fi vendors. Have you been following this at all?
Oh, you mean the CSIRO, who apparently invented the technology? Well, didn't apparently, they did invent the technology.
Yes.
Yeah, there has been some things floating around. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because I think half of the planet's infringing on their technology, certainly
right.
on the original patents and the copyright information. It was funded by a government body of Australia, and I'm not sure how tight the intellectual property is. But I mean, there's a number of things happening here at the moment, like everywhere else. You know, the government's looking at trying to force ISPs to police the internet, and iiNet, which is I think it's the third largest ISP in Australia. Is doing everything in its power to make sure that doesn't come through. And I have been watching. I mean, I was always an internet engineer first, you know, before I was in Sea Shepherd. So I have, and I owned my own internet service provider. So I do keep an eye on this type of thing. I mean, what I find interesting about your show is you talk about, you know, Arizona, I think was earlier on, about these laws. I mean, the interesting thing is the problem with all the laws being introduced is, one, is only so much people can retain. I mean, you can technically be breaking, we're all breaking laws every day. It's whether anyone decides to enforce it or not. And you can, you know, what's legal in one state is not exactly, you know, might be legal or not legal in another state. I mean, how do you enforce all this? I mean, where's the point when we're all going to say, well, it's got to be a global consensus of some sort? And I think that's what we're all trying to grapple with at the moment. You know, you've got intellectual property being used on a global scale now, as you said earlier on, this Wi-Fi issue is a good issue to discuss about that. And then you've got, you know, little laws like cyberbullying laws, I mean, that are enforceable in one state and not another. I'm finding it that it's becoming a little bit more complicated before it will have to simplify out. I mean, I don't know what anyone else's opinion is about it, but I just can't see it continuing on the current level. It's just going to be too many laws infringed on too many levels in too many countries.
Right. And probably, I don't know, personally, I don't see any real end in sight to that kind of problem, but I agree with you that it's terribly frustrating and there's no consistency. Derek, this sounds like a good sort of policy question for someone in your position. What do you think?
So this was actually, it's a fight that's been going on since the early days of the commercialization of the internet. So the first version was that everyone thought that it would be impossible for states to actually regulate the internet, that we'd all just be able to work around it too easily. And then the second version was, it turned out that states could regulate the internet pretty successfully, but we thought it was only the bad guys like China and Iran who were doing so. And now the third version of internet regulation, as Omar is mentioning, is that everybody wants a piece of it. So in the United States, right, the Obama administration is doing things like seizing domain names for gambling sites that are unlawful under U.S. law, or sites selling fake National Football League jerseys, or sites that offer streaming of Premier League matches. And this is something that is a sort of newly overt work by the United States to impose its will on what we thought of as a global medium. And Australia's done the same thing. So the Rudd government tried quite hard to push through legislation that would have required ISPs to censor everything on ACMA's blacklist. And that turns out not only to be, for example, pornographic sites, but some Queensland dentist who got reported, and also a anti-abortion site. And so I think that the differences between governments are just too strong for there to be any sort of international consensus about how to regulate a space that's as wild as the internet. And so I think that this chaos is just going to be ongoing. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. I don't mind that there are different rules in France than there are here in the States, because we all get to move around. We all get to live among like-minded people. And I'm not sure that I want a single sort of homogeneous set of rules for the internet.
I would agree with Derek completely.
Right. And it that certainly makes sense for someone who has the ability to literally move around on all of your various fleet.
Yeah, we would be in trouble every day probably. But I think in the long run, you've got Australia, which is rolling out the NBN network, the National Broadband Network, which was the centrepiece for our Labor government's election promise, an absolute centrepiece. Now, They use the excuses that they want to roll out this national broadband network to make business more advanced, to have the most fastest network. I mean, we all know in the industry it's simply so they can regulate it and, put it under government control and probably down the road privatize it as well and sell it for billions. But, they're trying to create a national broadband network so they can control it and, at the end of the day, they can only control as far as Australia. And then, of course, you've got the problem of other jurisdictions, which I think is a good thing. I think the internet is what's forcing governments and everyone else to be a bit more transparent. And it's certainly putting our conscience as a species up a notch, which is a good thing, particularly when you're in conservation. You know, we couldn't spread our word anywhere near as far and hard if we didn't have the internet. And I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we have a couple of other legal stories before we get toward the end of the show here. One thing, there's not too much to discuss about it. It just sort of bears mentioning, something we've kind of tracked along as it's been happening. The DOJ has now actually initiated litigation against Apple and five publishers, alleging price fixing and unfair competition, antitrust kinds of considerations related to ebooks. That the allegations are that Apple and these others are seeking to fix prices and have the market settle out at a retail price for ebooks somewhat higher than the $9.99 standard that Amazon seems to have set. And that they, according to the Department of Justice, who's been investigating, have, taken some steps that go beyond what they should do in the realm of fair competition. The European Commission is also investigating these allegations. The DOJ has offered Apple and these other defendants some settlement terms, which they have not taken up at this point. So it looks like this is going to go forward. Derek, do you have any thoughts on this?
To me, based on the documents I've seen so far, this just looks like classic price fixing. And the arguments that have been put forward by the publishers in particular are that this is necessary in some ways for their industry to survive. And that's precisely the rhetoric that you hear in every antitrust case, right? We had to do this. This is actually pro-competition. We're not going to be able to survive without it. And it turns out, right, that if you look at the history of antitrust, industries always adapt. And in part, this is, they're sort of trying to suggest that the sort of looming threat here is Amazon, right? And that they have to resist Amazon's price cutting. And it's, I don't actually think that it presents a risk for publishers. I mean, having ebooks is an immensely profitable new market. It's just that they're not making as much in terms of profit margins as they'd like. And that's the whole point of competition. The strange thing is that in a world of declining physical book sales, ebooks may well be the savior. And it turns out that content producers are just lousy prognosticators when guessing about whether things are going to be good or bad for their industry. So Jack Valenti, when he was working for the MPAA, famously compared the VCR. He said that the VCR is to the movie industry as the Boston Strangler was to a woman home alone. And he turned out to be precisely wrong. The VCR saved the movie industry. DVD sales are saving it currently, and internet-based distribution, as with Netflix, will do so as well. And so the publishers are resisting this not because it's any sort of threat to them, but because it's upsetting the business models with which they're most familiar.
Yep. So we'll just continue to watch that. It's going to be interesting to see how the whole ebook pricing situation shakes itself out, because it's kind of wide open at this point. Finally, let's make this our last story on substantive legal issues. In Boston last August, the First Circuit decided the Glick case. This was the fellow who was not making any secret about the fact that he was recording the police. And he had some pretty bad things happen to him, arrested and confiscated and charged. And he came back, and the basis of the case by the government against him was the wiretapping law in force in that jurisdiction. And what the First Circuit came down and said was, in order to violate that law, you have to, that law anticipated secret audio recordings only. And that's not what was going on here, with somebody openly videotaping the police. So it was a great decision for citizen journalists and actual journalists. Oh gosh, no, I don't mean to imply that citizen journalists aren't actual journalists. Let's say mainstream instead. Everywhere. And for anyone who just might be on hand when there is police activity going down, Mr. Glick brought a civil rights suit, and that has been settled in his favor for $170,000. So I think he's been fully vindicated at this point. This is the kind of thing that you pay close attention to at the InfoLaw blog. Derek, what do you think about this case?
I think it's critical, and it's something that I would assume it would also be a particular interest to Omar, because in some senses, Glick is really about not just journalism, but our rights to protect ourselves by recording what happens. So some police departments have adopted the policy of recording all arrests and all interrogations for exactly these reasons. And there are some really profound implications for this, not just for journalism, but for how far the Glick decision goes. So you mentioned the fact that the wiretapping statutes really seem to contemplate circumstances in which, for example, I'm recording someone secretly, or I'm taping a phone call. And the question is, really, is that the only limit here? Because one could think that perhaps the crux of the Glick case is that it's interaction with the state, it's interaction with the police. Or it might be that, in fact, any state, and a number of states have what are called two-party consent rules. So it is unlawful to record a phone conversation, for example, unless you have the consent of both parties. And does that mean that those statutes are unconstitutional? And if so, that would be a major holding. But I think this this ruling, even though it just applies to the First Circuit, is particularly important because we're seeing much more aggressive use of these eavesdropping prosecutions. And so, for example, one place that has a good deal of these is Chicago and Illinois more generally. And a Cook County court recently found that that state statute is unconstitutional, essentially along the same lines as the First Circuit. And so it's something that can be used to chill not only journalism, but our own ability to protect ourselves in a situation where we're facing force or the threat of force from the state. So I think it's a powerful and decision that I think is likely to influence similar courts in future circumstances.
Omar, have you guys ever turned the cameras on the police as they were boarding you attempting to confiscate things?
Oh, for sure. There's a fantastic bit of footage about this. I mean, for us, the camera is our most powerful weapon. It really is. You know, I mean, you've got, you know, of course, the cyber war and the ships and everything else, but the camera is what speaks a thousand words for us. And in a recent film that was produced in called Confessions of an Eco-Terrorist, it's Peter Brown's film, and it's a documentary. It's just been released in the US at the moment. It has 35 years of him as a cameraman, you know, following Sea Shepherd, and some of the boardings and moments when the police, particularly the Faroe Islands police, boarded the ships and what would transpire, and the fact that the police were trying to read out an arrest warrant to Paul Watson, Captain Paul Watson, and there's like 1,000 cameras surrounding them, you know, and they were very nervous. And and this was, you know, a number of years ago. So yeah, it's something that we keep an eye on. But then, of course, you know, that's within a jurisdiction of a country. Now, you know, what happens if the Japanese board us in international waters while our cameras are filming? I mean, you know, Sea Shepherd is testing or will probably in the next couple of years test areas of the law that haven't really been tested before. So, you know, we wait to see what will happen. And, of course, you know, any case that comes up, we aggressively defend. And so far, so good. We've had some successful time this year. In fact, we've had, I think, two or three cases this year which have gone our way. Again, it's on the Sea Shepherd website. I did post the link earlier on about the transcript of the particular case I was talking about earlier on. And it's something that we're keeping an eye on. I suppose at the end of the day, you've just got to do what you think's right. And our organisation, we try to adhere to the laws. We try to break no laws. You know, we might push them. And when Paul Watson did an interview, not an interview, he did a speech at the FBI Academy last year, funny enough. And someone stood up and said to him, well, Mr. Watson, you know, you really, really tread a fine line between what's illegal and what's, you know, legal. And, you know, Paul's reply was, well, as long as I don't step over that line, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. So,
exactly.
You know, we probably tread the line carefully, but we do try to adhere to the law in every sense that we can. Because if we start breaking the law and becoming, you know, violent and we will lose public support very quickly. And, you know, and Japan's frustrated because the fact is we've not broken the law and we've never been charged with a felony or any major crimes in the 35 odd years that we've been around. And we have been around for 35 years this year, I believe. So, you know, we push the boundaries when we can because we want to make a difference, but it's becoming harder to make a difference without possibly down the road breaking the laws. So we shall see what happens.
I used to talk about sailors having a woman in every port. It sounds like you all have a lawyer in every port, or maybe several.
Yeah, I mean, last year, I mean, you know, we proudly state that, you know, most of our donations goes to the campaigns directly. I mean, I'm an unpaid director. I don't get paid anything. In fact, you know, a good portion of my wealth goes towards Sea Shepherd and the campaigns we do. And last year, I think we probably spent more money on lawyers than we wanted to, certainly over the last few years. And, you know, we have won, though, in each case, you know. There was a recent arrest in Taiji with the Dolphins, you know, the movie where the Cove was based. And Irwin, who got arrested for being accused of pushing a guy. Now, that's a very interesting case if you look on our website. The fact that he got accused and held for months, you know, in jail, in remand, until he was even seen by the courts just because he got accused of pushing someone is an interesting, you know, travesty of justice in our view. Mm-hmm. And it just goes to show you how different laws are in, like in Japan, where they've got a 98% conviction rate apparently. So, you know, you're expected to plead guilty even if you're not. And in this case, we were lucky. The judge threw the actual case out. But Irwin still had to spend, I think it was 2 or 3 months in remand and maximum prison, you know, in a cell with barely any food and just a mattress on the floor before he went to court.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. And I think it just underscores what you were saying before about walking pretty close to the line. And I was looking before the show, trying to find information about, you know, people weighing in on the legality of your activities. And the one thing that I found was a little blurb on the Animal Planet website where they had 4 legal experts opining on that very question. And 3 of the 4 of them thought, yeah, no, what they're doing is just not really legal. And one of them said,
yeah, go on,
okay,
sorry.
Well, one of them said, yes, they're under the World Charter for Nature, individuals have a duty to act. And that gives the legal justification for the sort of vigilante approach that you guys take in enforcing the laws that the Japanese whalers should be following.
Yeah, so the problem is you've got, it's a, laws are there to be written to supposedly protect the public and, you know, and the people. But the problem is over time and governments get entrenched and laws get written and history comes and goes, many laws don't get renewed or changed. You know, you have an issue where the laws are become, they start to serve the people less and serve corporations and governments more. And in our case, you know, you're at the stage in society now where there's for every law, there's someone who can counter it. I mean, you know, quite often we've had arguments on both sides of the fence, you know, well, are we doing something that's legal? Are we doing something that's illegal? And it comes down to this, whoever on the high seas whoever's got the largest ships will probably rule the waves. And in the instance of the Artigil that was rammed a couple of seasons ago, you know, this was an interesting investigation. Japanese and New Zealand authorities ruled in the end that the both captains were at 50% each, you know, negligent in this regards, and that there wasn't enough evidence to rule any which way or the other. Although the Japanese didn't cooperate with Australian authorities on the investigation and wouldn't and refused to send any evidence. But in that case, you have they quoted in the documents as a final ruling that they didn't have enough information to proceed with a thorough investigation. Yet here you had, you know, three camera crews with high definition cameras. You had 18 CCTV cameras on our ships. You had at least five or six CCTV cameras on the Japanese ship. It was the most documented collision in history, right? With high definition footage, everyone, yet still everyone argued back and forth who was right. You had stop motion footage in Australia. Marine experts, legal experts, and no one could agree who was at fault. And in the end, what that was saying was that the conclusion, no one wanted to reach a conclusion because Australia and Japan is Australia's second largest exporter. And that's what it comes down to. So this is, you've got to look behind why laws are there. And if they're there, will they actually be adhered to? And will people follow the spirit of the law? And then, you know, it's not happening as much as it used to because it depends on whose interest is being infringed upon.
Right. Derek, you can point your law students to this show, I guess, as proof that they'll have jobs in a couple of years.
Absolutely.
When they're done.
There's going to be a lawyer in every port. I'll remind people that actually New York was once one of America's largest ports. So if you need a good attorney here, give me a ring.
Exactly. Well, hey, Omar, you set up really well for us, I think, with your talk about recording and well documenting the things that happened to Sea Shepherd, including when they're boarded by the police. There is a great piece over at, let me find it now. I just was looking at it. Oh, I'm looking at it now. At Gizmodo, that is a follow-on the Glick case. And it is a detailed piece with seven rules for recording the police. So this is our tip of the week. If you are someone who's in a position of needing to record police action, I strongly suggest that you go and take a look at this piece on Gizmodo in its civil rights section. I'm not going to go through it in too much detail, but it has great principles. Know the law wherever you are. And Omar was talking about how complicated that can be. Don't secretly record the police. That was the key point in the Glick case, about whether you're going to violate things like wiretapping laws. If you're doing it in public, you're going to have less chance of doing that. You want to respond to the inquiries from the police. Don't just ignore them. You know, engage with them. Have eye contact with them. Don't be obstreperous. Don't share your video with the police because that could certainly make them motivated to seize it from you. You should prepare to be arrested. Know that that's a danger in this activity. You should master your technology and make sure that if you can lock things down so that you're not inadvertently sharing your video with the police, you should password protect things, etc. Don't point your camera like a gun. That's a pretty good tip. Anytime a cop thinks you're reaching for a gun, that's a bad thing. So you want to make sure that it's pretty obvious that you know, that they know that what you're doing is there and documenting. So really good resource, I think, regardless of your jurisdiction in the U.S. or the world, for anyone who is going to make it a habit or even, you know, think it might occasionally come up that they might be recording the police. So thanks, Gizmodo, and Steve Silverman, who wrote this piece for them, who's executive director and founder of FlexYourRights.org and creator of the film 10 Rules for Dealing with the Police. So wonderful tip there if you're going to be engaged in that activity. And our resource of the week, I'm going to just, you know, turn it over to both Derek and Omar here to plug the heck out of the interesting things that they are involved in. Our official designated resource of the week is the blog that Derek contributes to, the Info Law blog, which, you know, I think our show today has been a great example, all the things we've covered, of the things that you guys cover on that blog. Over on your About page, you write that information law is an obvious convergence of intellectual property, communications regulation, First Amendment norms, and new technology. And I think we've touched on all those things today. So thanks so much, Derek, for providing Info Law as this great resource. And why don't you tell us a bit about the Brooklyn Law Incubator and Policy event this summer or this Sunday?
So this Sunday, the Blip Clinic, which is an effort that's led by my friend Jonathan Askin at the law school and by a really dedicated group of students, is coming together to try to hack IP law and internet law. So we saw the debates over the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act. And this is a goal to try to crowdsource, to get together lawyers and technologists and activists and sort of smart people generally, and to see if we can come to some consensus on how to do these things better. So if anyone is in the Brooklyn area, this is just going to be a fantastic event. We're going to have keynotes from all sorts of famous people like Tim Wu, and there's going to be a chance to actually do some good. So if you're around on Sunday the 15th, technically tax day, please come by and see it. We're in downtown Brooklyn.
Right, and you're moderating the whole Hacking the Act event.
And I'm going to be in the middle. We're going to have people on both sides of the Stop Online Piracy and Protect IP debates there. And so I think I'll be sort of refereeing a food fight, which I'm looking forward to.
Good. Bring your plastic sheeting. Sounds like you'll need it. It would be great to be able to go to this. I love the idea of a legal hackathon. I talked about it last week on the show too. So if you're in the New York area, I think going to this would be well worth your while. Anything else you want to let us know about that is going on in your neck of the woods?
I think that the other thing is just one of the bits that I'd be interested to get reactions from your viewers on is that we had a visit from Hollywood in Brooklyn that Paramount Pictures has been on a bit of a sort of a roadshow to talk about problems with motion picture piracy and the internet. And so it's something that has gotten some coverage from Ars Technica and TechDirt and other places. And so it's something that's ongoing. And so if your viewers have any thoughts, please post comments on the blog and I'll pass questions along for the next round of law students who are going to hear from Hollywood.
Great. Wonderful idea to do that. Omar, you guys have been occupying the Southern Whale Sanctuary long before folks were occupying Wall Street. So please accept my personal thanks for that. And I assume the thanks and appreciation and good wishes of lots and lots of our viewers and listeners. Personally, I was a child of the 70s when I was a little girl growing up in California. Saving the whales was something we espoused, you know, in sort of a visceral way. And the rest of the country kind of made fun of us for it from time to time. But it's still very much a part of who I am. So it's great that you guys are down there doing the work that you're doing. And I really appreciate your coming on the show today and sharing some insights about that with us. Tell us about the next season and what else we should look for from you.
First, thanks for allowing me to be on your show. It's been very insightful, and a lot of the topics you're talking about, by the way, are interesting to me. With my other hat on, you know, I certainly I'm part of the cybersecurity task force in the UK, and so I'm finding all this very interesting. And I'd be happy to come back if you invite me to talk about other areas or more C-SHIP, if you like. But this year we've got a very a busy year to a point. At the moment, the three ships that you see in the show, the Bridget Bardot, as I said, is going from Perth to Melbourne shortly. The Steve Irwin, the flagship, is currently moored up in Melbourne, in Williamstown. And the Bob Barker is in Hobart. They're all doing tours at the moment. So if any of your listeners are Australian, please contact C-SHIP at Australia. It's just you can browse it on the internet. It'll come up with the phone numbers and you can find out some details about visiting the ships. But the ships are going to be sitting in port because the fuel's very expensive. And in previous years, you know, we would hit the Mediterranean campaign for the bluefin tuna campaign, but this year we're not going to do that. I'm going to Cannes, and Paul Watson, Captain Paul Watson's going to Cannes to do some fundraising there. But In the next couple of months, there's a shark campaign that's being formed. And in this year, mostly we're preparing for the next year in that regards to the ships with the technology. The ships are getting some maintenance done to them, and we're not going to send them around like we do every year. So it'd be more preparations for the next year, because next year there's a lot going to happen. And, of course, you know, you've also got 20 or so episodes for the public to enjoy, although we are in the business to be one day out of business. That's our goal.
That is a good goal. And it's really interesting, too. You were mentioning how social media is sort of your fourth boat. I guess your fifth boat is all of the documenting that you're doing of the activities. You know, I mean, I guess you could just be out there fighting the good fight without documenting any of it, but it's the documenting of it that enables you to go to con and raise money. And so it's a real interesting convergence of media and technology that you guys find yourself at.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I believe firmly that Sea Shepherd is at the forefront of utilizing the latest technology with a very small budget, comparatively speaking, to other organizations like Greenpeace, while using the best diverse talent that we have within our ranks and with an inspirational leader like Captain Paul Watson. And, I tell you, if anyone's out there and has a chance to see Paul, and he's got, a talk coming up in New York and a 35th anniversary in Colorado, I suggest they go and check him out, because he's a very inspirational character. He's been doing it for a long time. I was a little bit skeptical when I heard of him initially. You know, I was a business guy, you know, in IT, and I thought, oh, you know, whale huggers, you know, what nonsense. But once I looked into it a little bit more, I realized that what he talks about, which is biodiversity, and that the fact that our oceans have to survive. If our oceans die, we die. It started to strike a chord. And, of course, it does start striking a chord when you're our age, doesn't it? You know, your 30s mm-hmm. or 40s, and you start thinking about, you know, if you've got kids, you know, are they going to, you know, move on? What's the future going to be like? So, yeah, definitely. So I would encourage anyone to have a look at what we do and you know, possibly contribute. And hopefully we can all make a difference.
Right. And one way that you've been trying to increase your reach and make more of a difference is on Google+, where you and I ran into each other. You've got your own personal page there, and the Sea Shepherd has a page. Where else are you reaching out with the fourth boat there?
Okay. Well, we've got the I'll put them on the to the ISE link here, but we've sure. Basically our Google accounts, people can follow me because I might say a bit more personal stuff, but really, you know, follow the Sea Shepherd if you want to see them, the latest news on the Sea Shepherd accounts. We're on Facebook, of course. We're on Twitter under Sea Shepherd and Omar Sea Shepherd. We do have Instagram accounts. We have all the accounts. You just look for Sea Shepherd and we appear everywhere. But I'll put the links up for the Google+. And the Google+ page, we would like to increase followers on that because it's very new and there's not many one there. I mean, it seems quite quiet, Google+, to me at the moment. But then again, I look at someone like yourself and I think, my God, she's got thousands and thousands and thousands of followers. So we just must be not out there yet.
Yeah, I think the pages in general, since they launched later, that there has been slower uptake on them. But I encourage you to stick with it, because there are the growth on that social network has been unlike anything I've ever seen. You know, there are graphs out there that show how much faster people have gotten on it than Facebook or Twitter or something else, you know, like that in their infancies. So I don't think it's going anywhere. And I definitely think that there are, you know, millions of people in a truly global audience on that network that I'm not used to seeing really anywhere else. So I think it's a great venue for you and hope you'll stick with it.
Yeah, definitely. And if you know, I'm happy to come back on the show and maybe if I can convince Paul maybe or someone else to jump on the show as well, which would be a special thing. Sure. You know, Paul's starting to see the benefits of social media. I certainly had to initially drag the organization a little kicking and screaming into the modern era. But of the last couple of years, you know, usually hear a big scream on the ship if the Facebook page goes down, because he's on Facebook quite a lot now. So
that's great.
It, it's becoming to a point where, you know, the comms officer lives or dies on the ship depending on if the internet's running or not. So it's a precarious role to have.
That's right. And on the high seas, I'm sure that becomes more complicated than just in the average office environment. Well, guys, this has been so much fun. I'm so glad that you were both able to join me. Derek, have a great time this weekend at the hackathon. We'll watch your blog and your Twitter to see how that all was. And keep up the great work in New York.
He actually had to run, so
he's gone. Left. Well, Derek, goodbye in absentia. It was wonderful having him on. What a great guest. And Omar, I just am thrilled to have had the chance to chat with you here today. It's been great, great fun.
No problems. Thank you for having me.
All right. And you've mentioned a couple times, yes, I would desperately love to have you back. We will coordinate that. And you know, once again, I realize it's going on a very, very wee hour of the morning here for you. So we'll definitely have you on at a point where you feel like doing an all-nighter once more.
Oh, no problem. I'm a global child these days anyway, so it's no problem for me.
Okay. Well, wonderful having you on. And thanks so much, everyone who joined us today. After the show, you can check out our Google Plus page or our Facebook page where I post up things between the shows that we're going to talk about. And I hope to hear from you about what you want to hear about next time. And you guys are my stringers. You know, I hear from folks who are listeners and viewers of this show before I actually see the new legal decisions that have come out, because you guys are watching them like hawks. So I really appreciate your cluing me into new things when they happen. And we'll chew over them in more detail as we can with the great panels that we get on here. You can also email me that stuff. I'm Denise at twit.tv, or you can find me over on Twitter. I'm D Howell there. And you can find our show at twit.tv/twill. The whole archive is there. We're in iTunes and in various places where you like to look for video and podcast entertainment, including YouTube. So however you enjoy the show, we're glad that you do. And we hope you'll keep coming back to This Week in Law. Take care.